Replicate indicates chute deployed.
The navigation has confirmed that the parachute has deployed, and we are seeing significant deceleration in the velocity. Our current velocity is 440 meters per second at an altitude of about 12 kilometers from the surface of Mars.
Heat shield set.
Perseverance has now slowed to subsonic speeds, and the heat shield has been separated. This allows both the radar and the cameras to get their first look at the surface. Current velocity is 145 meters per second at an altitude of about 9.5 kilometers above the surface.
On February 22nd, NASA released video footage of the car-sized rover Perseverance landing on the surface of Mars. After a journey of 7 months and 293 million miles, the robot vehicle finally reached the Red Planet with the aim of searching for ancient signs of life on Mars. The rover itself costs $2.7 billion, and the mission as a whole many times that. A couple of weeks later, Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, tested a prototype of Starship, a vehicle meant to enable mass interplanetary travel and the eventual colonization of other planets by humans. This, according to Musk, would be an insurance policy against possible events like nuclear war or an asteroid collision that could wipe out all of humanity if we were to remain on Earth. But is it ethically justifiable for a government to spend billions of dollars on sending a remote control robot to Mars when that money could be spent on improving the lives of its citizens? Should we leave space exploration to eccentric private individuals like Elon Musk? Or does that compromise humanity's future in space? Would it be okay to try and change the surface and atmosphere of Mars to suit our human needs? And what ethical framework should we apply to our potential future interactions with alien forms of life if they have evolved in radically different ways from life on Earth? Welcome to The Philosopher in the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. I'm delighted to have as my guest today Brian Patrick Green. He's the Director of Technology Ethics at the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, right in California's Silicon Valley. His work is focused on the philosophy of technology, including the ethics of artificial intelligence, the ethics of the technological manipulation of the makeup of human beings, and, crucially for the purposes of today, the ethics of space exploration. In his forthcoming book, Space Ethics, he explores many of the moral questions that arise from a likely future of space exploration and colonization. Brian Green, welcome to The Philosopher in the News.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what were your thoughts when you saw the most recent images of Mars being broadcasted by NASA's rover Perseverance?
The videos and pictures were quite amazing. It was, especially the descent video, was just amazing. It was really impressive to get that view of coming into the Mars atmosphere and landing on the planet. That's something that's never been done before. And the pictures from the surface were really amazing. I think that one of the things that NASA has been wondering about in the last few years is how do we actually get people interested in space again? Because they recognize that if people don't actually care, then they don't get the budget for it, right? So they figured out, oh, maybe if we show them a cool video of actually coming into the atmosphere, they'll think that that's worth the money for. And you know, you can spend that money on a lot of different things, of course, but.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a minute. But interesting that you mentioned that NASA is aware that it sort of has to kind of glamorize a little bit space travel again to get people interested in it and then maybe get some more funding from the federal government. I was going to point out that one of the photos that I saw that went viral, I'm sure you must have come across it, this very, really stunning photo of the three planets, Earth, Venus, and Jupiter, as seen from Mars with a dramatic sunset, and the colors were really stunning, which was supposedly taken by the new rover, turned out to, in fact, be a composition of various other photos. Do you think we still think of space more through this kind of medium of imagination and science fiction rather than kind of the reality of it, which sometimes might be a bit less glamorous?
So I think you're right. I saw that picture and I actually shared that picture on Facebook and I said, yeah. Oh no, afterwards. When I looked at it, I said, huh, this is a little bit higher resolution than I was anticipating the rover to be able to capture. So, but I shared it anyway. And then I said, oh man, that's like the fourth or fifth thing I've shared on social media that's fake. And I keep track of these things because, you know, I've been on Facebook for over 10 years now. And it's like, I think it's good to keep track of the accuracy rate, right? So even if you're being careful, you still get taken in every once in a while. But the other really disappointing thing about that picture is that the person could have just said, this is an artistic impression of what it looks like to be on Mars. And said, I'm not trying to misrepresent what I'm doing here. But instead, they decided to do that. And so, thus the disappointment, right?
We all got taken for a ride there. Exactly. I also shared it on Twitter, And it was really interesting because it was quite a different photo from a lot of the other photos that we have from Mars that are often a little bit colder, especially the sunsets are much cooler colors. And they have a sort of post-apocalyptic kind of feel to them because obviously the sun is a lot kind of darker than it is sometimes from Earth. So I was really taken by that photo. Talking about things that went viral, another thing that I saw around this kind of Mars landing that went viral was this kind of classic meme. And I don't know if you saw this, which is the classic meme of the man holding the hand of a woman, being distracted and turning his head to look at a different woman passing by at the astonishment of the first one. And the characters of the meme are always labeled something different. And this one had the man as humans. The woman he was holding hands with was planet on which humans evolved into intelligent, healthy beings because it contains all the resources needed to survive. And the woman passing by, the one by which the man was distracted, was just labeled desolate planet with nothing but red dirt. So do you kind of understand that sentiment, that it's kind of absurd to get so enthusiastic about a planet that, for all we know, is just a desert unable to sustain life?
So it's not just that it's a desert and it's really dry and darker and farther away from the sun. It's also that it's covered in perchlorate, which is a compound which is toxic to humans in large doses. There are lots of things about Mars that are not attractive. And yet at the same time, I think it's clear there are a lot of people who are not attracted to necessarily the most easy way of life, right? They're looking for something difficult. They're looking for something hard. When Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon, one of the quotes that he said is magnificent desolation, that this is the most desolate place that he had ever seen in his entire life. And there's nothing that was like that. So it was magnificent to him. And when John F. Kennedy gave the moon speech back in the early 1960s, he said, there are some things that we do not because they are easy, but because they are hard. And I think that there's a certain part of the human psyche, or whether it's part of our culture or exactly how it fits in, I'm not sure. But there's a desire to do things that are hard, not just to have an easy life, right? But to have a difficult life.
Especially when it comes to travel. I had Emily Thomas on a previous episode talking about the philosophy of travel, and she's written a book about the meaning of travel and how philosophers have thought about it through the ages. And that was one of the same questions I asked her, is like, why are we so fascinated with going to really faraway places, really inhospitable places on Earth, you know, to explore even the peaks of mountains and, you know, the depths of the ocean, really freezing areas of our planet. But yeah, it seems that we do. We're gluttons for punishment. Sometimes we enjoy the we enjoy the challenge.
Just to continue on that, there's an excitement to it, right? There's the excitement of being the first person to ever see a place, or the first person to ever stand there, to know that only a limited number of people have been there before. And also the feeling of accomplishment that you've actually done something which is difficult and you can be satisfied with the hard work that you've done.
Yeah, and interesting, that kind of ties in with a question we'll discuss later, which is that, you know, seeing space travel as a kind of purpose, as a kind of end of human activity. But let's come back to something you've already mentioned, which is, you know, space travel is really expensive. And usually when people talk about the kind of politics and ethics of space travel, in at least in non-philosophical contexts, the arguments one usually hears have to do with, you know, the enormous cost of traveling into space, how that money, especially when coming from the budget of governments, could have been spent in different ways, ways that could have improved the lives of people here on Earth. I read that in today's money, the Apollo missions, you know, would have cost somewhere between $200 and $700 billion. You know, that's an eye-watering amount of money. So do you think that space travel is ethically justified? Was that money on the Apollo missions well spent?
So that's a really important question. It's probably the number one question, I think, when it comes to space travel and ethics. Is it actually worth it? And I think that you can always do that calculation, right? You can say, what are we getting for this, for the cost that we're putting in? And research and development is always that way. I think that one of the things we should think about with space is, what are the research and development input costs that we have to put in, and what do we get out of it? If you look at the Apollo mission in particular, of course, there was a large geopolitical context associated with it also, which is that the Soviet Union, the Cold War, the Soviet Union was winning the space race before that. And so there is this international question of whose system was better, right? Is it the Soviet Union or the United States? Mm-hmm. And we can look back on that now and say, well, obviously, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed after a few more decades. But that, of course, was not at all obvious at the time. And we can wonder what would happen if the Soviet Union had gotten there first, right? That would have been a big difference in history. And I think one of the other things to recognize is that we're still benefiting from that that science and technology that was explored back then, and also the infrastructure that was built on that. Because, of course, the Earth is surrounded by satellites now, and we have satellites not just in low Earth orbit, but in geostationary orbit. We have all these assets up in space that do all sorts of amazing things for us that we don't think about usually. For example, GPS and communication satellites and so many Earth sensing satellites in terms of watching climate change happen and things like that. It's been really important for Earth science and for knowing things about our own planet to be able to get off the planet and get the bigger view looking back towards Earth. And I think actually one of the most important things I think that we can say is these Earth sensing satellites have made us very conscious of the fact that Earth's environment is changing and that we have had a negative impact on our planet, whether it's watching deforestation happen or whether it is watching the climate change and the Earth's temperature increase or ice sheets melt and those sorts of things. That input of money, which was pioneered by early missions like Apollo, is certainly worth it, because we recognize now that we need to change our entire economy. We need to change our entire way of life and energy system if we are going to maintain the planet that we have right now.
Yeah. So in some ways, some of the things you're saying are making me think of space travel almost like we think of basic research, basic scientific research into things that we don't really know that they're going to have an imminent application or that they're going to, you know, change our lives in some way. But very often down the road, they do have a great impact on how we go about. I mean, obviously, basic science is much less well-funded than space travel. I remember being a physics undergraduate and the theoretical physicists, you know, always complaining that there was never enough money for basic research, because the argument was always, well, what's the use? You know, what's the point?
I was just going to say, just to continue on that, first of all, NASA's budget's less than 0.5% of the U.S. budget. So it's actually quite small now. And even in the time of the Apollo mission, it was about a little over 4% of the U.S. budget, almost 4.5% when it peaked. But overall, I mean, you're right. R&D research, at least publicly funded research and development, has decreased significantly over time, just in general. And a lot of that has shifted towards the private sector, which is good. But of course, private sector doesn't really do that fundamental basic research that doesn't have an immediate monetary return on it. Industry is happy to do research that gets the money, but they're not going to do a lot of the very fundamental stuff if there's no obvious payoff for it. So that's really something that that we need the government to be able to fund.
Although, speaking of the private sector, of course, we do have, you know, some private individuals, very, very rich individuals, people like Elon Musk and his SpaceX program, who who do want to invest a lot of money into space travel and have plans to colonize Mars as part of a business venture, not as part of, yeah, basic research. So should we be concerned that such individuals might go on to explore and colonize space on behalf of their own kind of private business interests? Or, you know, should we be relieved that the public don't have to fund these extravagant projects and instead just, you know, we just let these private individuals burn through, you know, their own money as part of humanity's effort to move beyond Earth?
So I think the answer to that question is both. there's obviously a benefit for the public funding these things in that everyone benefits from it. You know, every NASA photo is public domain, which is great, right? We get to see what the government is getting or what science they're returning to us. When Elon Musk goes to Mars, it's not going to be all public domain. There's certainly going to be PR, and there's certainly going to be marketing and sales based on that. But it's not going to be, just released to the public for free. And if they discover amazing things there, you can imagine that those things are going to be monetized in a particular way that benefits what mm-hmm. he's doing. But at the same time, NASA really has been not progressing into space very much in terms of manned space exploration or person mm-hmm. space exploration. So there is a benefit to having these private individuals spend the money, right? But there's a trade-off here for sure. There's a trade-off. And we have to, as we go forward into the future, it's going to be interesting to see how these trade-offs play off with each other.
I guess to some extent, maybe we're not that concerned about this happening now, given that it's in very early stages. You know, ideas of colonizing Mars still sound really far away. But if it does get to a point where that seems a lot closer within our kind of technological grasp, I think those questions will become a lot more urgent. You know, is it, you know, finders keepers, the first person that arrives on Mars, you know, can, you know, claim the planet for themselves? Or you know, will there be a kind of regulatory kind of legal framework around how even private individuals kind of go on to explore space? Is there such a framework at the moment?
So there is. The Outer Space Treaty says that there can be no territorial claims staked in space on any space body. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of Elon Musk going to Mars and claiming it is illegal from an international perspective. Okay. But then the question is, who's going
to
enforce it, right? So
So is this a UN legal, is this international law?
It is an international law through the UN, but not all countries on Earth are party to that treaty. So potentially if Elon Musk wants to go to a different country, he could do that and escape enforcement, although I have a feeling that the other countries in the world might be a little upset about that. And so, I believe the way the treaty is structured is that whichever is the sending nation has jurisdiction over the location. So, if he's flying out of the United States, then the United States ends up having jurisdiction over whatever settlement he might start developing up there. And of course, there's an incentive on the part of the United States to want that to proceed, most likely, because it probably accrues economic benefits to the United States. But at the same time, you don't want someone that you're sending up there to proclaim independence from you, right? Because all of a sudden, you've just lost some influence as opposed to gaining it. And of course, this is the whole history of how these things have related to colonialism on the past on Earth and things like that. How are we actually going to set up this sort of political interaction in the future?
Yeah. That would be my next kind of question about the kind of framework through which we approach these ethical questions around space exploration and the colonization of other planets. And it very much, in your research, you kind of try and relate it back to human history of doing this, of colonizing the discovery of the new world by Europeans and all the ills as well as the benefits that kind of came out of that. Why do you think that's the right framework, given that for all we know, we don't have, you know, there's no evidence that there is life, at least as we know it, on Mars or any of the other planets of our solar system? So is the model of, you know, our colonial past which of course, you know, for the most part kind of ended up affecting, you know, the people of the places that were, you know, supposedly discovered anew. Is that the right framework for thinking about space travel?
So I think it is for a few different reasons. And I think one of them is the very fact that people talk about space colonies, right? The word has transitioned over into discussions of space travel. And really, I don't think that's the right word to use. We can talk about space exploration. We can talk about space settlement. We can talk about using resources in space. But the idea of colonization, you're right, is very different because we're not likely going to run into Martian intelligent people on Mars. That likelihood is pretty close to zero. However, we might run into microbes. This is something that there's an entire section of work on space called planetary protection, where they try to protect science going forward. They try to prevent forward contamination, contaminating the scientific object that they're going to study, because if you discover E. coli growing on Mars, that's going to be a bad sign that you've contaminated the planet and you might have wrecked whatever science there was to discover there in the first place. And also to prevent back contamination back to Earth of any potential Martian microbes or things like that. And that, of course, that relates to colonialism in that currently, or at least the history of Earth, in that we have, of course, when the first colonization of the New World happened, all these diseases went from the Old World to the New World. It probably resulted in something like 90% of the indigenous inhabitants of the New World dying from disease, which is just unimaginably terrible. Shouldn't be a problem in the future. However, it's possible. And so we have to think about these forward and backwards contamination issues. And of course, getting beyond Mars also. For all we know, there are life forms in Jupiter's moon Europa under this. The entire planet is an ice, you know, coated in miles of ice on the outside. But if you go down through that ice, there's no telling what could be in that warm liquid ocean down there. There could be quite sophisticated things down there that we don't know about, multicellular life perhaps, completely unknown because we have no idea, and it's under miles of ice. So these forward and backward contamination issues are really important. But returning to the question of the colonial mindset, not only is it the word, but I also think the exploitative mindset comes along with it too, which is that we're doing this for a reason, for either self-aggrandizement, to gain us resources, to make ourselves more powerful. And that's really, that exploitative mindset is really a bad mindset to have. And yet we know that from human history, we know that that exploitative mindset is really easy to fall into, and it's hard to escape. And so from an ethical perspective, it's really important for us to acknowledge that at the start and recognize that we need to do better in the future.
Yeah, really, really hard to kind of draw lessons from you know, the exploration of Earth to the exploration of other planets. But yeah, interesting to keep in mind, obviously, what happened in the past.
Just one more thing that I would say about that would be that you can see this in the way that people talk about Mars or talk about the moon in terms of we're going to create giant robots that go around digging up the landscape and spewing out greenhouse gases on Mars, for example. And a paper was published a few years ago saying we could warm Mars up to Earth-like temperatures in just 100 years if we release these giant robots on the surface that just go around digging up all the planet's surface and spewing out greenhouse gases out the back. And that type of mindset, of course, should set off alarm bells in that ethical consideration of how we interact with other objects. Because first, there is a possibility of there being life there. But even if there is no life, should we just be going to other objects in the solar system and wrecking them in that way? Because really, that's just going to a place and assuming that it belongs to you. There are all sorts of it's that exploitative mindset, once again, which is that this is here for me and I can do whatever I want to with it. And that has some very fundamental ethical problems with it.
Yeah, so these are the kind of ethical challenges that come up with the idea of terraforming, right? Of trying to form Mars in a more kind of Earth-like condition. Interesting that you think that there are ethical considerations beyond sort of possibly having a negative impact on any life that we just haven't detected there yet, that there is a kind of value of, you know, that part of nature in itself, that we should, you know, treat it not purely instrumentally as just a thing for kind of our own benefit, but somehow give it some respect independently of that. I mean, what is the argument for that, other than, you know, we generally don't like the exploitative mindset when it comes to our own planet, and we've seen that that can have negative impacts, obviously, on both the planet, but also ultimately ourselves as well. What would be the argument there about not doing that with Mars? Is it just a precautionary principle that, you know, we never know what might come of this behavior, or is it more a kind of pure, absolute moral principle here that we just need to treat all parts of nature with a level of kind of respect?
So I think there are a number of different approaches that you can look at it from. I tend to come from a virtue ethics perspective. And so if, for example, you look at Mars as a lifeless place, let's assume there's no life there at all. You come at it from a different ethical perspective, say utilitarianism, you can say, look, this would be fantastic if we could transform Mars into something like the Earth, because all of a sudden we've created more space. More things can live there. There'll be more pleasure where there was none before. Of course, there will also be suffering associated with that life. So that's a whole nother question, whether those balance out with each other. But I think from a virtue ethics perspective,
films are a warning.
Yes.
most Mars exploration films don't end well, do they? Yeah, there's a lot more kind of human suffering ultimately than pleasure, yeah.
This is one of those interesting questions about human imagination, right? Which is that it's easiest for us to imagine a lot of bad things going wrong or happening. Mm-hmm. And it's also more interesting, right? If you just showed, hey, Mars is perfect and everyone there is happy and nothing ever goes wrong, then people will say, oh, this is a boring movie. They'll feel like watching this anymore. But kind of continuing in that vein, I think if you come at it from a more virtue ethics framework, then it becomes, and you think about the fact that humans are habit-forming creatures, right? And so the way that we treat non-living matter will affect the way we treat perhaps living matter and perhaps the way that we treat other human beings ultimately. Mm-hmm. I think we have to try to get away from that exploitative mindset.
Can you say a little bit about what virtue ethics is here for our listeners?
Sure. Virtue ethics is the idea that while some ethical systems tend to look at actions, so for example, utilitarianism and Kantianism or deontology, they tend to look at the actions that people perform and whether that action will be good or bad. Virtue ethics looks at it in terms of who is the person making the action, and Is that action going to create good habits in that person, or is it going to create good habits in who that person is interacting with? Is this something that's promoting good character, trustworthy character, for example? And those sorts of questions, it's just a different perspective on ethics. You can look at ethics more from the action perspective or more from the perspective of being. And of course, it turns out that action and being are reciprocal with each other. You become what you repeatedly do, and you are more likely to do actions that are part of your character. And so virtue ethics tries to take this larger perspective, which looks more at the character of the person doing the action and recognizing that that's going to affect culture, it's going to affect institutions, it's going to affect history, ultimately. And I think one of the things happening right now in Western culture, at least, is this recognition, actually, that this exploitative mindset has been very bad in a lot of ways. Not only has it hurt a lot of people, it's caused lingering effects with the way that we treat each other, but it's also extremely damaging to the environment, and it destroys a lot of things that can't be replaced. There's something valuable there that is being lost. Yeah. And if we instead back up and analyze this, and a lot of environmental ethics is doing this, a lot of intersectional ethics and feminist ethics have talked about these things, then hopefully we can free ourselves from that and do better in the future. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to make these improvements, because although the past got us to where we are, which is good in some ways, it's also not as good as it could be. We have a lot of improvement to do for sure.
You're listening to The Philosopher in the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. As always, this podcast is created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. Check out The Philosopher's website for upcoming events, including a webinar with Naomi Oreskes in conversation with me about her book, Why Trust Science? A Bold Defense of Scientific Expertise, revealing why the social character of scientific knowledge is its greatest strength and the reason we should trust it. Go to www.thephilosopher1923.org/events to register for this and many other events for free. Something that you mentioned in that response triggers this other question about extraterrestrial life, which is that there is a kind of question about, you know, that doesn't really seemingly have to do with ethics, even though it will affect how ethics kind of is thought about and applied, and how we might treat or interact with extraterrestrial life. The question is, how will we know if and when we do come across it, especially as it might not resemble life as we kind of know it, as life as it has evolved on Earth? What are the philosophers of, you know, I know there's this kind of field of astrobiology thinking about life outside of our solar system or outside of our planet. How do they approach this kind of question about what life might be?
So first of all, this is a really hard, not only scientific, but as you say, it's a philosophical question, ultimately. What does it mean for something to be alive? And lots of proposals have been made, and there's nothing agreed upon right now. But some of the proposals include things like metabolism. Does this entity or whatever it is that you're dealing with, does it have chemical processes going on inside of it of its own accord? Does it have inputs and outputs? Is there something going on there metabolically that seems to be an indication of life? Because that's certainly an indication of life as we know it. Another definition that astrobiologists use is, does the organism undergo Darwinian evolution? In other words, does it have generations? Does it undergo natural selection where it changes over time? That's a very different perspective from metabolism, which is, I think, worth looking at or at least thinking about. And, of course, it also takes a certain amount of time to analyze, right? If it's a microbe, maybe the generations will be a few hours. But if you're looking at something that's much more long-lived, or if it's growing in a very harsh landscape or is used to growing in an extremely harsh landscape, it could be extremely slow-living. It could be something that takes years or centuries or who knows how long to actually undergo any type of evolution. So that's another one. But building more on the metabolic side of things also is, does it have any form of homeostasis? In other words, does it maintain equilibrium in itself? Does it have balances on the ways that chemicals or chemical reactions are running inside of itself? Because that's certainly a hallmark of life on Earth. And then a third or a fourth approach to it would be, does it seem to be seeking anything? Because this is another thing that life forms tend to do. And you can think of this either, you know, in the philosophy of biology has gone into all of these, whether it's teleology, is there some sort of purpose-seeking behavior there that's a real purpose-seeking behavior? Is it teleonomic? In other words, it's just a programmed purpose-seeking behavior. It's not real purpose-seeking behavior. Or is it teleomatic? And the teleomatic idea is just that it's automatic. It's not even, we shouldn't even think of it as being teleology. We should think of it as being just something that happens, that teleology isn't real.
Can we say a little bit about what is teleology and what is teleonomy and what the difference between those two might be?
Right. So teleology is the idea of real purpose-seeking behavior in nature. There are a few different perspectives on this. There's a perspective that says teleology is not real at all. It doesn't exist in reality. It's something that only exists in human minds as a figment of our imagination. So eyes are for seeing, right? You can say, what is the purpose of an eye? The eye gives us the ability to see, and that is purposeful for our organism. As our organism develops over time, we eventually, you know, through our embryonic development, develop eyes. And then when we are born into a world, we are born into a world with light, and we can see with those eyes. So there's obviously some type of purposive connection between the fact that we have eyes and we have an environment where we can see around us. If you wanted to look at that from a more teleonomic or teleomatic perspective, you would look at it more mechanistically and say, purposes in biology are not the same as, for example, the purposes of the words coming out of my mouth in order to convey information. Humans perhaps have purposes, but nature does not. And so those should be interpreted teleonomically, which is that we have DNA inside of us, and that DNA acts mechanistically through some very complex interactions through embryogenesis, which eventually leads to us having these eyes. The reason we have eyes is because our ancestors who did not have eyes did not fare as well as those ancestors that do have eyes. And so we should look at this as a completely mechanistic process, which has no endpoint to it. It's merely an adaptation of organisms to their environment. And the reason that we see in the spectrum that we see in, for example, that we see visible light as opposed to infrared or ultraviolet or X-rays or radio waves is because our atmosphere, for example, is particularly transparent at those, you know, our star, first of all, produces well in that spectrum. And our atmosphere is also particularly transparent in that realm of the spectrum. And so and of course, also there's something beneficial to us to be able to see. It gives us more information, makes us better able to adapt to our environment.
Yeah. So that would be the evolutionary kind of argument for explaining what an eye is versus the teleological kind of framework that sees it as having a purpose, which is also obviously more linked to a kind of design sort of model of nature, right? Whoever designed it with this in mind, as having this kind of.
And this is a really interesting philosophical question, also, which goes into questions of cognitive science, of religion, and whether the human mind is making gross errors, right, in the way that it interprets reality, probably connected to the fact that we use tools, right? Because we know that there are tools, we are tool-making creatures, and so our minds are particularly connected to those ideas. We're also language-using creatures, and so all of the symbols coming out of my mouth right now in the form of language are extremely remarkable in the detail that we can go into. Of course, other creatures create noises and communicate symbolically with each other also. But we can see how this sort of teleology or purpose of behavior exists in humans. And then the question is that something that goes deeper into nature? Does it go into biology? Does it go into perhaps the purpose of the universe? Is there some way that this connects to it? And when you start asking questions like that, it's very hard not to get into theistic interpretations of it. And of course, that gets into, you know, the history of Western culture and things like that. But I've talked to astrobiologists who phrase it differently, and they say, is the universe about something? In other words, we don't have to think about purposes, but is the universe doing something? Is the universe about something? And that's a slightly different way of phrasing it. It's a more non-theistic way of phrasing it. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for the use of imagination in this sort of work to really think what is going on here, not just in terms of human life or intelligent life more generally, or biological life or non-living things in the universe, but big picture, is there something going on that we should be aware of?
Yeah. Does the universe as a whole have a function, like the eye has a function? Is there a function to the universe? Is it doing something?
And very often we tend to look at that as a category error, right? And it may well be a category error, but I think it's one that our human minds are particularly disposed towards, and we shouldn't dismiss it just for that reason, right? We should, I think it's worth considering because it's something very core to humanity. And so I think it's worth investigating, even if the answer is no, we don't think there is.
Yeah. A really fascinating set of questions that we could spend a whole hour talking only about those. But the follow-up question to all that is, how do we think of ethics given all this? So a lot of our ethical frameworks about how we interact with other people or other creatures are based on the assumption that the others were humans or animals, that they're like us in important ways. And especially for Kant, it was, you know, the important thing was being rational. And so having rationality sort of gave you this kind of moral status. And so Kant would be, you know, happy to expand this to any alien life that is also rational, but, you know, maybe not to non-rational one. For utilitarians, it's the ability to feel pleasure and pain. So, you know, people like Peter Singer would like to expand that ethical framework to include animals? And you might have already answered this in some way, because for Aristotle, as we said, it isn't really about the action. It's a little bit more about the person doing the thing or interacting with someone else. But how might our ethical frameworks be challenged when we are dealing with extraterrestrial life, if it turns out that that life is very, very different from life as we know it?
So the first thing I would say is I'm glad that you brought up Kant as the kind of the first question, or the one of the specifics that you said there, is that Kant is all about all intelligent life, which is actually really remarkable. Mm. And he maintains that because, you know, significantly earlier in his life, he wrote about extraterrestrials. Mm. And of course, he talked about the solar nebular hypothesis and some of these very interesting things that people don't tend to read mm-hmm. Kant for anymore. Yeah. But his understanding is that there should be intelligent aliens out there. And the way he envisioned it is that as the aliens, as the ETs were progressing through the planets in the solar system, that they would become more intelligent the farther they got away from the sun. Mm. And they would become less intelligent the closer they got to the sun. And of course, there could be some very bad assumptions built into that, which could be explored, no doubt. But his idea was that the fact that humans are on the third planet means that there are actually others out there that are probably going to be much more rational than we are, which I think is also kind of an interesting perspective mm-hmm. on things. So Kant is actually completely prepared for alien intelligence. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One of the things that's interesting about utilitarianism is that I think in a lot of ways utilitarianism is kind of the wrong metric. It measures pleasure and pain, but pleasure and pain I don't think correlates with good and evil in quite the direct way that is an optimal way for thinking about ethics. And of course, that's debatable because, of course, utilitarians don't agree with me. Mm-hmm. But I think that when it comes to extraterrestrial intelligence, ideas, you know, critiques of utilitarianism, like the utility monster, could appear. So, for example, we could meet extraterrestrials who think that humans are just delicious, right? And they get so much more pleasure from eating us. Right. Than we could possibly have in our entire lives. And therefore, that's just the way to maximize utility in the universe.
We should be their breakfast.
Exactly. We're tasty. At the same time, we could possibly envision aliens, intelligences that have no cares in the world. They don't experience pleasure and pain. Perhaps they're artificial intelligences that have had that, they never had that developed in the first place, or perhaps they are biological organisms that had that removed from themselves and negotiate certain types of behavior in some other way other than pleasure and pain. And so this really breaks utilitarianism in that case, because we'll see these organisms and say, you can't feel pleasure or pain. We can do whatever we want to you and it doesn't bother you.
You have no ethical status. Yeah, no moral status.
Yes, exactly. And I think there's some even scarier options too, which are very much once again get into science fiction scenarios for folks who have read The Three Body Problems by Cixin Liu. In The Three Body Problem, these aliens, these extraterrestrial intelligences, basically decide that humans aren't worth anything compared to themselves, and so they can destroy us and replace us. And then it turns out that the entire universe is that way. It's really, really dark perspective. Of course, Cixin Liu wrote those in the early 2000s. But about 10 years before that, there was another science fiction author who had this same type of system. He had the same type of story where basically anytime aliens discover each other, they kill each other, because obviously, the value of their own lives is worth more than whatever value other organisms have. And for that reason, all of a sudden, everybody becomes really scary, because as soon as you discover something else, all of a sudden, the prospect of extinction is on the board. And based on that, if you look at it from an exclusive utilitarian way, in other words, we're not going to include those other aliens, we're just going to think about ourselves, all of a sudden... Mm-hmm. The moral calculus is thrown way out of whack, and it goes all in one direction towards protecting yourself and attacking the other. And if they do that on the other side, then it's the same thing, and you get in this very negative type of interaction. One other thing with utilitarianism, of course, would be how do you evaluate the ecosystem of another planet, right? So if Mars has microbes on it, those microbes are going to have very low moral status because they can't sense pleasure and pain in nearly the same way that humans can, if they can really register it at all. And this really throws the balance out of whack, because once again, it's humans having very clear pleasure and pain. Or even if it wasn't humans that we put on the planet, we could put a bunch of, you know, cattle on Mars or something like that. They would have more pleasure or pain than the local microbes.
What would the virtue ethics Aristotelian framework tell us about interacting with other extraterrestrial life?
One of the interesting things about Aristotle is that the framework's a little more nuanced. And I think that there's been some environmental ethics based on Aristotelianism, for example, environmental virtue ethics, that has really thought about not only humans and how we interact with the environment, but also the fact that every organism in the universe, anything that's alive, is seeking its own good. It's seeking its own end or its own purpose. You know, it's as simple as survival and reproduction a lot of the time. And so every organism on Earth is like that. And any organism that we ever meet will also be like that. And based on that, it gives a great deal of opportunity for nuance and kind of differences in the way that you evaluate things. And it also gives the opportunity for humans to look at different forms of life that are very strange and very unusual, and think to ourselves, what is it doing? What can we do ourselves that will help it with its flourishing, and that will hopefully at the same time lend to our own flourishing, to our own better character?
Is it kind of almost like an adaptation of the Kantian principle of treating other rational beings as ends in themselves? We have to treat all beings as having ends of themselves, of their own, and so of treating them as having some kind of value given those ends.
Yes, it expands it a little bit. You're right.
You mentioned human eating aliens and the possibility of encountering rather hostile extraterrestrial civilizations, maybe even their technological artifacts, or maybe even their remnants. So there have been philosophers who think about whether it's a good idea in the first place to go out and explore space or broadcast our presence to the universe, given those kind of possibilities. What do you make of this argument? Might it be too risky? If we are pretty confident that there is life out there, that we are not the only living creatures in this kind of enormously vast universe, you know, we are living on a planet of one star in a galaxy of, I don't remember if it's billions or trillions of stars.
About 100 billion stars, yeah.
100 billion stars in a universe of billions and billions of galaxies. So, you know, it would be outrageous to think that only on planet Earth could you know, life kind of evolve. So if we do think that, you know, there's a pretty good chance that there is life elsewhere, is there an argument for being rather careful about how we go about seeking it?
So once again, we know from human history that the interactions between different groups of intelligent beings can lead to very negative outcomes, whether it's extermination or near extermination, or even what we consider to be potentially good outcomes are still very transformational, because one of the cultures or both cultures is going to be going to be very changed by what happens. I think the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, has been interesting. It's an interesting exercise just in and of itself as a thought experiment. But of course, they've actually been looking for radio signals out there. And of course, just last year, they think they might have gotten a signal from Alpha Centauri, which is extremely close.
Yeah.
And also, once again, it's the plot line of the story of the three-body problem, which is anyone who's read that story and then heard that happened, they're like, oh no, this is terrible. But this idea of just listening is really interesting, because even just, I guess, a couple decades ago, a scientist wrote a paper saying, do SETI signals need to be decontaminated? Could they potentially have a computer virus in them or something else? Something could be embedded in that message, which could get into computer systems and damage them. Turns out that's actually really difficult, because they'd have to know how our computer systems work in order to hack them. And because interstellar distances are so far, even if they got a look at what our computers looked like 50 years ago, then it's probably not going to work anymore. But there are other ways that that could still go very, very wrong. So the answer is yes, SETI signals probably do need to be decontaminated, and that is done. They tend to break them into pieces and analyze them very carefully. Building on that, there's then the idea of, should we message them? Should we send out messages to other stars? And this has been a very big ethical controversy, I would say, in kind of the searching for extraterrestrial intelligence community. Should we be actively sending messages out there? This has been done before. There was an Arecibo message that was sent out back in, I think it was the 70s, but I'm not sure. I'd have to check on the date. But then they decided to stop doing that because they recognized, oh, maybe this isn't the best idea. Maybe we do need to be a little bit more careful about this. And so there's a threat component to it. And it's worth thinking about. And it's not just a threat to us also, right? It's also, imagine if let's say, go back to the year 1300, and somebody in Europe had a radio transmitter, and somehow they managed to broadcast a message to the Aztecs in the New World. That would have been a really strange message to get. And all of a sudden, you're not just worrying about what could happen to the sender, right? Because the Europeans were slightly higher technology in the 1300s, not seriously higher technology. So the Aztecs weren't necessarily going to be a threat to them, but the Aztecs getting that message could have had their entire society disrupted, right? And then it becomes a question of, well, we don't allow human experimentation in that way. You're not allowed to go into somebody else's civilization and just screw them up like that. There are institutional review boards that exist now because of all the bad scientific experiments that have been done in the past. And there are some interesting papers coming out on this.
Yeah, so risks not only to ourselves, but potentially, to whoever else is out there.
Exactly.
Disrupting this, again, possibly perceiving that message as a looming threat, right?
Right.
And the kind of, impact that might have.
And even if you say something nice, like, hi, nice to meet you, we're friendly, you can't trust them because you don't know anything about them. Even if they gave you an entire history of their planet, right, and how friendly they were, there's still no way to trust them because you don't have a third-party verification. You can't verify it yourself. There are a lot of huge, and ultimately these are kind of socio-political questions where you say, oh, can't even figure this out on Earth.
Yeah, let alone getting like into interstellar diplomacy. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so, we've spent a lot of time talking about, all the potential kind of ethical challenges and hurdles that can arise out of our desire to explore space. But despite of all of those, you actually believe that there is an ethical argument for space travel. You think we should go out to space. And perhaps the strongest argument for that has to do with space travel being a kind of insurance, right, against existential risks to humanity as a whole. Things like climate change, nuclear war. Can you expand a little bit on that? What is that insurance policy exactly like?
Sure. So this gets into some of the philosophy of a philosopher named Hans Jonas, who was writing in the 70s and 80s and very early 90s. And Hans Jonas argued, look, there's really only one categorical imperative, and it's not what Kant said it was. It was what, it's what he decided, or he thought that it was, which is that ethical creatures need to exist. You can't have ethics if you don't have ethical creatures that are actually capable of doing ethics. And therefore, the first rule of ethics is to make sure that you have ethical creatures around. If you don't have any organisms or intelligences capable of ethics, then ethics doesn't exist. And therefore, that's really the first categorical imperative.
What is a categorical imperative?
So a categorical imperative is something that is always correct. It's not a hypothetical imperative. A hypothetical imperative says, if you want something, then you do this. A categorical imperative is something that is always correct. You need to do it no matter what. Kant's version of it, of course, is that, let's see, he has three different versions. I'll be happy if I can remember two of them. Always treat others as ends in themselves. Don't use them purely as instrumental means. I know the third formulation is the kingdom of ends, which is that everybody cooperates together Oh, sorry. The second one is the universalizability, or maybe that's the first one. Universalizability is first, and then don't treat others as means is the second one. Yeah, act always so that your rule can be universalized.
So yeah, act in such a way that you can will everyone else acting by the same principle that you act in that case.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so that is Kant's version, and this
Hans Jonas,
yeah, argues that actually the first ethical principle is you need to have ethical creatures around, creatures that are even interested in talking about or thinking about ethics, and therefore we need to preserve humanity. Is that more or less it?
Exactly. And it turns out I've written papers on this, like what are some sheltered places on Earth? Well, you could hide in submarines, or you could build refuges on islands and things like that. But if you want to be really safe from really big disasters, you need to be off the planet. And, you know, of course, one of the logical responses is, why don't we just spend the money on reducing the risks on Earth? Yeah. Because that way we actually save so much more. Mm-hmm. It turns out that even with a lot of effort being spent on, for example, nuclear arms control, we haven't solved the nuclear arms control issue on Earth, even though we've been working on it for almost 80 years now. And so we have to, at a certain point, we have to recognize maybe these problems are not easily solved here, and we need to think about the plan B. And the plan B is that if we have at least humans on another planet, or it could be the moon, it doesn't need to be Mars. And if we also have life forms there also, we can preserve the Earth biosphere. We can preserve Earth life. It doesn't have to just be human life. It can be a benefit to everything that's ever evolved on Earth.
Mm. Why doesn't the argument go the other way around? So Hans Jonas says, well, you know, if no humans are around, there's no kind of ethics to talk about. Well, in that case, you might say, well, and then therefore no problems, right? Therefore no ethical kind of clashes or you know, ethical conundrums between good and evil. If we do think that, I mean, that line of argument suggests that ethics is a kind of, you know, it's a kind of human construct almost. It's something that it's a cultural product. You know, why? Well, though, I guess there would be two versions of that question. Why place all the emphasis on that cultural product, the ethical cultural product, and not say on, I don't know, masterpieces, art masterpieces? And, you know, without humans, there would be no art. Therefore, you know, we kind of give art this absolute value, and we have to preserve humanity so that art is preserved. Yeah, but also the kind of counter argument that, well, look, if humanity comes to an end, you know, so be it. At least there won't be any this won't be either good or bad, because there just won't be any ethical kind of arguments to debate.
So this is the great thing about philosophy, right? Is you can make the counter argument. And negative utilitarians, for example, make that counter argument. They say, forget about pleasure. Life is suffering, right? And how do we get rid of suffering? Well, we get rid of life. And that's an extremely kind of, you know, that's why they're called negative utilitarians, right? They're trying to minimize the suffering side of thing. And there's only one way to really do that. And you end up with a very different perspective on reality. The reason that Hans Jonas does this is because he actually is coming from a non-theistic panpsychist perspective, which is that it looks like the universe is about something. There's end-seeking behavior in the universe, and those ends that are being sought, we have to assume are good, although we could disagree with them. We could say the universe is doing something wrong and we need to fight against it. But he thinks it's more reasonable to go along with the grain of the universe, if you want to think about it that way. Mm. And then based on that, there seems to be some purpose to human existence, and it doesn't matter if you're trying to produce art, right? When you were talking about we should have art, you used the word should, which is an ethical, you know, word right there.
Mm. Well, normative, yeah.
Yeah, it has an ethical valence to it. If you say life is about sports, or life is about war, or life is about whatever you want to say life is about, that all of a sudden gives a teleology to what we're supposed to be doing here, and that produces shoulds. At least hypothetical shoulds to him, right? Which is that if you want to have sports, then you need to have humans in existence. Or unless you want to have everybody go extinct and just have robots playing sports after we're gone, right?
Yeah. So this is a kind of broader idea of what ethics is about. It's kind of questions about what what life should be all about, rather than like thinking of it in a more narrow, kind of moralistic framework about, you know, good and bad, as it were, good and evil.
Exactly. It gets into deep kind of meta-ethical and metaphysical questions. Meta-ethical meaning, how do we know what good is? How do we know what we're actually doing? What's the right way of finding the good? And those sorts of questions. And then metaphysical questions, things that cannot be explored by science. They have to be looked at in different ways.
So thinking about this kind of question about what life is all about and what are our human ends, I found another argument that you make very interesting. We've already talked a little bit about the more instrumental kind of side of the argument. Space travel is good because, you know, a lot of benefits come from it, technological benefits and so on. But one of the arguments you give is that space travel in some way moves us. It's something that gives us purpose. And moreover, it gives us a kind of shared identity. A purpose of sustaining humankind into the future is something that we can all share as human beings. And, you know, I think the first reaction to something like that, you might be, you know, oh, this is just like, you know, luxury feelings and reflections of people in very well-developed societies that, you know, have solved all of their material needs and so on. But you say that in your encounters with people from all around the world, no matter how kind of poor the countries they come from are, feel a kind of deep connection to this idea of space travel and space exploration. And I found that quite interesting. Can you say a little bit more?
Yeah, I have a couple examples. The first one is from a friend. His family was from East Pakistan at the time, now called Bangladesh, of course. And when his parents heard that people had walked on the moon, they said, wow, that's amazing. His mother wrote a letter to Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong and said, I think that what you've done is so amazing. Can you please give us some sort of memento or send me your autograph or something like that? And she got a signed picture of Neil Armstrong sent to her in wow. East Pakistan. And that was, you know, one of her most precious possessions after that, just as an example of way in the past. And then to build on that, I was in the Marshall Islands for 2 years out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's way, way remote. And then for a certain period of time while I was out there, I was even farther out on what they called an outer island. And while I was staying on the outer islands, you know, one of the things you do when the sun goes down is you look at the stars, and the stars are amazing out there. And we looked up at the moon, and the family we were staying with said, is it true that people walked on the moon? And I said, yes, it was about 30 years ago. And then the father of the family said, why don't they go back? And I said, well, it was really expensive, but I'm not really sure. I mean, it's something that they just decided not to do. And he looked at me and he said, I think they should go back. And I think it's this idea of amazement, right? There's something about this which is it's transcended, really. It transcends the material conditions that you're living in. It's something that all humans can share. And of course, maybe not everyone feels that way, but there are a certain number of people around the world who do feel that way. They get that sensation from it, and it's valuable. And I would say even more. You know, broadly speaking, there's kind of a crisis of purpose going on right now in cultures around the world, not just Western culture, but a lot of cultures. And it manifests in a lot of negative purposes appearing, whether it's nationalism or racism or all sorts of longing for the past. Back when people had purposes in the past, you look back towards that. And all these sort of pathological purpose-seeking behaviors appear. By the way, video games are a prime example of seeking purposes and accomplishments in a way that is disconnected from reality, but which feeds that need, right? It gives you what you're looking for. It's really important. I would say it's not a luxury. It's something that's in a lot of cases, it's more important than life itself. And you can see that in all sorts of examples of people dying for various things that they believe in, whether that's the right thing or the wrong thing to do, right? It can be a very pathological thing that they've chosen to die for. But, that idea of purpose is very, very core to human psychology and our entire culture.
Yeah, it transcends, as you say, kind of material conditions. So I usually ask a last question about, you know, a book recommendation related to this topic, and I will ask you for one. What do you think is the best place to go for thinking about the philosophy of space travel? But I also want to ask for a film recommendation, given that, you know, space has been covered so much in film and continues to be one of the mediums through which we sort of imagine it.
What I would say in terms of book recommendations is that there's a lot happening right now in terms of bringing this kind of very academic discussion of space exploration and ethics down to something that's more accessible. There are a lot of edited volumes out there right now, for example, edited volumes of academic papers. And so those are not necessarily accessible, mm-hmm. and they're really expensive. But if people want to check them out from an academic library, if they have access to those sorts of things, there are good resources right. on that. Books by, for example, Connie Burtka and Jim Schwartz, Tony Milligan, Kelly Smith, Carlos Mariscal. Kelly Smith and Carlos Mariscal have a volume mm-hmm. on astrobiology. And a book from back in 1986 called Beyond Spaceship Earth, which is a really good edited volume, and it's also quite accessible. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, one of the things I would do also is just, you know, Google it. If you look up space ethics, you'll mm-hmm. find resources on it. If you want to, you know, who are the good names in the field, you can think about who the academic folks who are writing these, some of whom I just mentioned. Carl Sagan, of course, was fantastic at this. So Carl Sagan's, and I think his Cosmos series, the original Cosmos series, is still really, really good from back in the 1980s.
And of course, your book will be coming out in September. What will be the title?
The title is Space Ethics, and it's
pretty
meant for...
self-explanatory.
Yeah, it's that's the idea, right? It's, of course, it has a target audience of undergrads in university, and but it's meant to be accessible to everybody. So it has, you know, it has mm-hmm. all the terms that are defined in a glossary, and it makes it easy, and it has you know, references if you want to go deeper. But the idea is really to present something which is accessible and gets people into the topic and in a way that's hopefully enjoyable and really lets you stretch your imagination, because I really find that the idea of space exploration stretches ethics, and also these ethical concepts stretches the idea of what's going on with space exploration, and it really raises these interesting and difficult questions. Oh, and you wanted a movie recommendation.
Well, if you find the movie recommendation harder, what about a non-academic book about space travel? You've already mentioned The Three-Body Problem. Is that where you would send people?
So The Three-Body Problem in the whole trilogy, The Three-Body Problem, The Dark Forest, and Death's End, those are three of the best books on these questions that have come out recently. And they come, and it's wonderful that they come from a different cultural perspective also. It's enlightening in, mm-hmm. in multiple senses. There are so many good science fiction books on this. I also highly recommend books by Kim Stanley Robinson, his Mars trilogy that he wrote in the 90s, are really good books. And there's just so much good science fiction out there.
Well, Brian Green, thank you very much. This was really interesting.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
To listen to future episodes of The Philosopher in the News, subscribe and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, please spread the word and leave us a rating and a review. Really helps others find us. Next week, something slightly different, a joint episode with the Political Philosophy Podcast and its host, Toby Buckle. It may not dominate the news in the way it did over the past 4 years, but Brexit is still lurking in the background of the political developments in the UK and its relationship with Europe, the US, and the rest of the world. So did Brexit result in the UK's independence, as Nigel Farage promised? Was the vote for Leave a vote for freedom, as Boris Johnson proclaimed? Toby Buckle and I will attempt to answer these questions by revisiting Isaiah Berlin's classic essay, Two Concepts of Liberty. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher and the News. Speak again next week.